in Hubble next Tuesday morning at 8. And I've asked for the Q&A session to be scheduled Monday at 5:30. So around about 5:30 to 7. I'll have to send an email when I get the room. So it's possible in settling the room, the time will shift a little bit. Any issues, questions about the exam? You can use two sides of a 9.5 file on the sheet of paper this time. Okay. Last class I actually muffed the explanation of one of the demos. I was sort of in ideal fluid mode, and I wasn't really thinking carefully as I was requesting demos quickly. And I requested one that, unfortunately, is a beautiful illustration of the fact that water is not an ideal fluid. What we did was a demo which looked something like this. I poured water in here, and then the water would flow out this pipe. And what the demo showed was that the levels here were different, but it was literally dropping as we went further out in the pipe. And truthfully, if you have an ideal fluid that is not viscous, viscous is friction, okay? Then, in fact, because you are incompressible, that means you have the fluid passing a point here is the same amount that passes there in a certain amount of time. It means the velocity of the fluid has to be the same since the cross-sectional area is the same. Well, let me consider here, not here, because the height here and the height here is the same as well. So if you have an ideal fluid, and this is all true, then you would expect these to stay at the same level, which when we talked about a minute, we were seeing. The fact is that we saw that they fall, and the reason that they fall is the fact that water isn't an ideal fluid. It's a convenient fluid, but it's not ideal. So if you consider what happens if you have a little bit of friction between the pipe and the surface of the pipe and the fluid, it turns out that you'll have something called viscous flow. So as the fluid goes through, you'll actually slow down a little on the edges here. And effectively, there's a little friction in the flow of the fluid through the pipe. So you're going to... the way I sort of think about it is that the velocity really can't change because your fluid is incompressible. But the friction is effectively taking some energy out of the system, so it affects the pressure thing. So the pressure will drop as you go further through the pipe. I'm not sure an engineer would maybe explain it that way, but having said that, if you now take the next step and look at what happens as water or any other liquid like blood flows through a pipe of constant cross-section, if you assume that you don't worry about changes in height, it turns out that there is a way to describe it is there's a change in pressure. That is, the pressure will drop as you go further through the pipe according to this equation. So this term, this K here, represents something to do with the pipe. Is it a square cross-section pipe? Is it a circular cross-section pipe? Etc. So that's what this depends on. This is the volume flow rate. This is something called the coefficient of viscosity, which depends on the fluid itself. And this is the length of the pipe where you're looking to find out where the pressure is. A guy named did a circular cross-section calculation. So way back when he came up with this law, where he basically just figured out what K is for a circular pipe, and that's a common one you run into. And so you end up with this equation, and you can maybe begin to see just how important it is. Suppose you have a fluid, so you have a fixed viscosity, whatever it is, you want to go a certain length, you want a certain flow rate. The pressure change is going to be tremendous depending on the radius of the pipe, and it goes as r to the 4. So for those of you who may worry about the body as plumbing, right, you have a small change in the radius of an artery due to plaque buildup or whatever, it it means that you'll have a huge pressure drop, and that means the heart has to work a lot harder to keep the same flow rate going. All right, so it's a very real thing. We're not going to do viscous fluids. I draw the line and only deal with ideal things. Turns out that this mistake of mine was fortuitous, because I think this is a nice discussion to have with this class, and probably I'll hold it a little bit more carefully in the class, but it was sort of serendipitous. So, any thoughts? But that's why you have the pressure dropping as you go further. Yeah. Right. In terms of studying, you don't really have to study this. And when it comes out the final time, I will send you a list of sections you are not responsible for, which will include the one on non-viscous flow. Having said that, obviously, you guys are here for an education, and there's nothing wrong with reading some of these sections that I don't assign, because some of them are pretty cool. And your need to understand physics doesn't stop the little boundaries that I assign for you for exams. Yeah.
So if I
talk
to one of my engineer friends about this, what she's telling is that as you move along, you still
okay, so the statement was one of his engineering friends says that as you move along, each of these acts as a pressure relief valve. I actually think I strongly disagree with that, and the reason that I do is that the pressure right here has to be equal between the fluid that's at the bottom and the fluid that's at the top. Basically, the pressure here has to be enough to support this head. And if you have this head sitting here supported, it's going to basically be high enough such that that pressure is equal. So, in a sense, you're not bleeding off anything to relieve the pressure, I don't think. In other words, this height will be such that it is so that the pressure is maintained to whatever it has to be at that point. So I actually think I disagree with that. Now, having said that, I don't worry much about viscous fluids, so maybe you've got an engineer friend who's done viscous fluids and knows more. At any rate, you can see that once you allow viscosity into the equation, once you allow viscosity in, you sort of open up an entirely new vista. So when you're dealing with real world things, you have to worry about the fact that water, blood, things like that are not ideal fluids. So, and in fact, you'll find that is the case for sort of many of the things that we're studying right now. We will make approximations to try to get at the essence of a lot of what's going on. But the minute you want to, you know, create a device to help somebody's blood flow, or, you know, do a careful calculation as to the kind of stress that some arm goes under, you know, it's not an ideal thin rod. So you probably need to do more careful calculations. But it can serve you as a good starting point in your thinking. So that's just a warning. Be careful when you get into the real world. And certainly, before I look up and find one of you cutting on me, I hope you do your homework. Yes.
If you had a setup like that, except instead of vertical beams, you just had holes, like holes punched into a compass, for example, would all the strings coming out be the same, throughout the same distance?
I believe you would find that the holes here, the water would be... You would have, that's a good question. Now you might have more like the pressure relief. I'm not sure what would happen to that. I want to think this will go up higher because you have a higher pressure right here at that point. Which may be true. It may depend on the size of the hole relative to the size of this pipe. If the hole's really big, then effectively it becomes that hole, and this is it, you won't get any water over here. So if there's small holes, then I think what happens is effectively the bleed off of the volume here is small enough not to affect what's actually happening inside the pipe, and you have a higher pressure here, effectively means you'll be launching the stream with a higher velocity and go higher. I'm trying to think if I've actually seen that. My guess is if you have a family who has one of those irrigation hoses where, you know, you turn on the water and it spouts out everywhere, you might actually be able to see this in action, that the spouts will be coming out the further, the closer you are to where the fossil is. But I can't remember clearly enough. So I like the word. Okay, so last time we started a topic, simple harmonic motion. And intuitively, what I mean by simple harmonic motion is quite literally something that just repeats in time like this. That's sort of your intuition. There's a bit more to it. And let this, your intuition about strings that you've built up, both thinking about the motion, but also the mathematics of how we use that, sort of guide you for simple harmonic motion. If I say simple harmonic motion, I mean a system where the mathematical, where the mathematics is really similar to that for a string. Okay? And we're going to let that guide us. So if we think about a spring, so let's assume that I have a spring attached to a block that is sliding frictionlessly on a surface, and we assume that, say, the spring has a length, a natural length of x0, and then we do what we do with springs, which is, you know, we stretch it out or compress it, and we have a change in its length. I'll call it x. And probably in a moment I'll define x0 to be the zero for my x scale, just for simplicity. So if we, in fact, let me just do that. So we know that f, in this case, goes as minus kx. And remember that k basically is something that says for a certain type of spring, if I extend it a certain distance x, the force isn't so great. For other springs that are stiffer, if I try to pull it the same distance x, the force is tremendous because it's a very stiff spring. So K simply describes the stiffness of the spring. X is the degree to which I have stretched or compressed it relative to its natural length. And the minus sign gives you the direction of the force. Okay, I've written this without vector signs because it's a one-dimensional problem. And remember, in one dimension, the direction is given by the algebraic sign. So in this case, if I pull it out, x is positive if I have 0 right here. X is positive, and f is negative, which means f is back toward the initial point. If I push it in instead, x is actually a negative number. That times a negative gives you a positive number, so f is net positive and pushes you back. Okay? So the minus sign does nothing but give you direction. Okay, so now what I'd like to do is to look at what f actually is. If the mass isn't changing in everything, F is MA, and A is the second derivative of the position with respect to time. And I can regroup things a little bit. And then this is what, if you want to impress grandma, you'd say this is a second order ordinary differential equation. in the position. Okay? And so if you want to turn this into a mathematics problem now, what you'd like to do is to find an equation that describes the position of this mass as a function of time. And if you solve this equation, that's what x represents. That's what you're getting. Okay? So one might say solving this will give you the equation of motion for the system. Now, if you've had enough calculus and differential equations, then you can probably look at this and just know what the answer is. I'm not going to drag us through any sort of formal procedure for actually solving such a problem. That's not what this course is about. What I'm going to do instead is I'm going to tell you what the solution is and then prove to you that it works. Okay? And it's probably a fairly intuitive solution, but one way to think about it is to solve this equation, I have to have a function in position and time for this, what x is, okay? And I have to be able to take the second derivative of that function and come up with something with the opposite algebraic sign so that these two things can cancel and give me zero, right? Harmonic functions clearly are, because you take the derivative of the sine, you get cosine, the derivative of cosine gives you minus sine. So harmonic functions will fit that. So let's just assume a harmonic function and see what happens. So let me hypothesize that x is equal to some amplitude times the cosine of a constant times time plus another constant. All right, and what these various constants are, we'll discuss, but just for reference, this is known as the amplitude. This is the angular frequency. And this is what you would call the phase angle, or the initial phase. And what I mean by all that, we'll come back to. But you will notice that I'll sort of draw the reason why we use omega here. It might bother you a little bit that I'm putting an angular velocity in the middle of this equation. Why we do that, try to make clear as we get a little bit further in. But sometimes you also have to keep things clear in your head based on context. Okay, so we have only so many symbols, so we reuse them. It is also, again, a theme, constant theme in this class. It is a certain degree of job security. No one else can know what you're doing. So, but there is actually a connection between this omega and the angular omega you're used to, which we'll look at in a moment. At any rate, we're going to assume that we have, this is our solution for, and it's a general solution, which is why I put these things in. And I'm going to take this form, whatever it is, and see if we can solve that equation. So we're going to need the second derivative. So the first thing to do is to take... Hello. The first... It's that's not me doing it. My computer is acting up. This is going to be difficult. All right. So we take the first derivative. And to do that, we pull out the omega because we're taking the derivative with respect to time. So we have A omega times the sine of omega t plus phi. And then we take the second derivative and we get minus A omega squared times the cosine of omega t plus phi. And now what I'd like to do is to simply take that first derivative that we found and the second derivative that we found and substitute them into this and see if it works out. So for reference, we'll bring this down here. So there's the equation, and so if we sub in, we have minus A omega squared times the cosine omega t plus phi, which represents the second derivative, plus we have k over m times x. So we have to do k over m, and then x is A cosine omega t plus phi. And this whole thing has to be equal to zero. So you can see from this that this is true if omega squared is equal to k over m. Omega is equal to plus or minus the square root of k over m. All right. So that's sort of the mathematics. You should prove to yourself, if you choose to start with a sine instead of a cosine, everything holds again. So you can use either sines or cosines. In fact, they're completely equivalent except for, they differ by 90 degrees. Alright, so let's think about what this really means. In this motion, what you have is this thing just goes back and forth, okay? And what makes it special is that in the event that you have a frictionless system, this just goes on forever. And it has the same distance from the midpoint on both sides, and it repeats in time. Okay? Mathematically, let's look at what we've got for our solution. We have A cosine omega t plus phi is equal to x. Phi is a constant that basically defines, let's say, do we define t equals zero here? Do we define it here? Do we define it there? Do we define it whatever? So at t equals zero, x is going to be some value. At t equals zero, x is some value, and that happens to be equal to A times the cosine of this function, this phi, whatever it is. And phi is just a constant. So phi is what ties the time zero for your problem into whatever the initial condition is. Do I start out with this thing fully extended? Do I start out with it not extended at all, but in motion? Okay? So that's why we call it an initial phase angle, because this is now a harmonic function, so we talk about phase of the harmonic function. We call it an angle because you take the harmonic function of an angle. Okay, what is omega? Let's think about what happens. If you'll note, this thing is repetitive in time. And that amount of time that it takes for it to go through one full motion is always the same in a frictionless system. We call that time the period of the motion. Alright? And what you'll note, what you want if you have a period, is let's say we start at this point at the bottom. Okay? That means in one period, I go up, I come back down, and I'm back to exactly where I was one period in time ago. So that means this function has to be periodic in the time of one period. So that means omega is defined as 2 pi over big T. Big T is defined as the period of the motion. How do I know it's 2 pi over the period? If I go one period in time, then I have 2 pi times one period, big T, over big T. That's 2 pi. If we set the phase angle to 0, so we don't worry about it. Cosine of 2 pi is exactly equal to cosine of 0. So that means you come back to exactly where you start. If I say I go a time of 2 periods, then I have 2 times big T divided by T gives me just 2 pi times the integer 2, which again, because it's periodic, comes back to exactly where you were. So when you define omega like this, it means that every time you allow a time T period to elapse, this piece right here becomes an integer times 2 pi, which means the function repeats. So when you define omega like this, you effectively are enforcing the periodicity of the function and relating it to time. All right, so let me examine it a little bit more here. What I'd like to do is to imagine that that I have a pen and I tape it on this thing and I have a piece of paper that moves like this as a function of time and the pen draws on it. So that if this is not moving, as the paper moves, all you'll see is a straight line. Okay? Now, if this is moving up and down, then as this moves up and down and the paper goes, what you're going to see is a wavy line being drawn. You okay with that? So we're going to use this sliding paper to give us a picture of how the function develops as a function of time. So if we think about what x is as a function of time, if I set phi equal to 0 and I start at the top of the motion, well, grid here. It'll basically look like that if you can sort of imagine what this will look like as a function of time as it goes. And all I've really drawn then is this cosine function where the high points in the motion, this is the amplitude. This is the amplitude. This is the amplitude. That's the distance that it goes. A is defined as the amplitude of the motion. I'm going to make it longer. So if I were to basically if we define this as x, okay, we're looking at x as a function of time as you go further and further, okay? So what you'll notice is that this thing will go up and down in exactly a time period. So if we start here, for example, and time is elapsing, it goes down and comes back to the same point, and we say that this distance in the time axis is defined as one period of the motion. All right, so if I have a shorter period, then this goes up and down faster. If I have a longer period, then it takes longer to go to the two extremes of its motion. All right, very simple. Short period, long period. Right? Okay, so to get a sense of where this omega comes from, perhaps in a different way, let me draw it first. Let us imagine that we have a circle on that circle lies with a midpoint on the x and y, okay? The x and y axes. And let us suppose that we have a ball here which is rotating this direction with an angular velocity omega, okay? And let us say that it goes around the circle in a time period big T. This is not so different from what we've been talking about, because if it's just going around like that, it is also periodic in time. And it will go a distance which is 2 pi times the radius of this thing in a period big T. So let me call the radius of this current circle, let me call it A. And I'd like to look at the projection of the ball's position on the x and y axes. This distance, if this is theta, this distance, which will be the y position, is equal to the amplitude times the sine of theta. This distance is equal to the amplitude times the cosine of theta. And remember that theta is equal to omega t, because that's how we define what omega is. It's the amount of angle you go through at a given time. So x is equal to a times the cosine of omega t, and y is equal to a times the sine of omega t. So if we don't worry about this initial phase angle, we suppose that the initial starting point we just define as 0. So that goes away. You'll note that the projection onto the x or onto the y is exactly what we said for harmonic motion. So you can sort of relate this circular motion to harmonic motion by considering the projection onto one of these axes. So there's an intimate relationship, because in a sense they're both periodic, so they have to be. So let's look at a system. So what I have is a ball, forget the arrow for the moment, and I have it set up so that it goes in a circle supposedly at the constant omega, but that's not looking so constant to me. Okay. Yeah, sometimes the real world is... So something's slipping in here a little bit. Sorry about that. But pretend it is a constant omega. And now, in order to see this motion projected on an axis, I'm just going to look at the shadow on the wall. So it is not in good shape, but I hope you can imagine that this projection basically gives you something like the motion of a spring. If I had a spring with the right K, for example, I could put it right here and have it go, and you would see the shadow would stay on the spring. But the motion projected onto the wall is exactly the same. Define this T as one period of the motion. We're going to use a new word. I think I've used it too much in here, physics-wise. We're going to define 1 over T to be the frequency. And it's sort of like English. If something is very frequent, it happens very fast. It happens a lot in a given amount of time. If something is infrequent, it happens not so often. Okay. So if you have something which has a high frequency, then the period is very short. Right? If T is small, then 1 over T is going to be big. Let's say that right. Yeah. So if T is small, 1 over T is big. Period being small means it comes back to the same point very fast, okay? If you have a low frequency, then T is... I'm sorry, did I say that? If you have a high frequency, T is small. If you have a low frequency, T is very big. That means it takes a long time before it comes back to where it started, all right? So we're going to use frequency or period sort of interchangeably. And the symbol for frequency, for now, I think we will call it F. When we get into waves, you will find that the symbol you use for frequency for waves, because they're waves, as you'll find, waves are very tightly connected to simple harmonic motion, so we have a lot of the same symbology. For sound, we will use F for the frequency. When we get to light waves, we will use the Greek symbol nu. It's effectively the same thing. It's just, again, you've got to make sure that nobody can figure out what you're doing, so we use different symbols. Generally, we use F. Okay, I will also call omega is also called the frequency. Omega is 2 pi over the period. So there's a relationship between this sort of core frequency and this so-called angular frequency. But generally speaking, people are a little loose about distinguishing between the two, and you sort of use context. If you're having to put it into some omega, some harmonic function, it has to be in this omega form to enforce the periodicity. Okay. but if you're just measuring something, you usually are actually literally looking at a watch or something. You're measuring the time for the period, and one over that is the frequency. So you just have to be really careful about that. The energy that you, what you know about springs carries over into simple harmonic motion, whatever is undergoing, right? You have the largest potential energy in the spring at the two extremes. You have the most kinetic energy in the middle, etc. So sometimes you may be asked to sort of use that kind of intuition. What I'd like to do now are a few examples of things besides spring. Well, we'll do one spring example and then talk a little bit about a couple of other things that involve some harmonic motion. So, do you have any questions on the basic idea? So one point I wanted to make is that sort of the way we do this is we start with a spring and we derive some formula, okay, and then we say, okay, this exhibits some harmonic motion because it's periodic. So what really do we need? K and M are just constants that happen to be a part of the spring system as we've defined it, right? If you have any system, whatever it is, and when you analyze the forces in that system and you find that it fits an equation, the second derivative of the position with respect to time plus some constant or group of constants times the position is equal to zero, mathematically it will execute some harmonic motion, okay? And the frequency of that motion, right, which is related to this period for its vibration, goes as, the frequency squared will go as whatever this constant or group of constants happen to be. And I know that may sound a little vague, but this depends on whatever system you're talking about. So if it's a spring, this is a K over M. So what in the hell is he talking about? I'll do some examples, but I don't have to really. Imagine if I have two nuclei with negative charge around them. If they come very close to one another, you have repulsion, and there's a force that will force them apart. If they get far away, you have more negative density here, which will draw them together. So it turns out that if you look at chemical bonds, they are very similar to springs, okay? All the constants are different. You don't talk about spring constants, and you don't usually really talk about mass. There'll be other constants involved, like electromagnetic things, and maybe etc. Okay, but when you look at this motion, you can actually derive that form for the differential equation. When you look at the actual forces, you can find, which means this thing vibrates a little bit, and it will vibrate at a very particular frequency. If you've done some chemistry, you know that different chemical bonds have certain frequencies where they will vibrate. And it turns out with quantum mechanically, you can have different modes of vibration. You can do transitions between different energies. So you can do transitions between them, and it's usually in the infrared, and that's what infrared spectroscopy is all about, is literally looking at different excitation modes for vibration of the bonds. Okay. And you know, you can take the force equation between two atoms or molecules or whatever and actually derive the fact that for very small separations it's a simple harmonic thing, and it ought to have a very particular frequency of vibration. So it's got some generalities to it that are really important. But let me look at a couple of examples so you can get a feeling for this. I want to look at a system which is called a simple pendulum. simple is not meant to be pedantic or offensive. It doesn't necessarily mean it's simple. It just means that it is a big mass hanging on a thin string so that you can effectively not worry about the moment of inertia of the string as like a thin rod or whatever. The minute that you make this a big rigid body where you have like a thin rod and you have to worry about moments of inertia, then you would not call it a simple pendulum. It would be like a compound pendulum or some sort of more complex pendulum. But let us suppose that we have a decent sized mass hanging on a fairly massless string, and we just pull it out a distance theta from the vertical. And what I'd like to do is to analyze this system. So if we look at the free body diagram for this body, or if we think about just the forces on this mass, we have mg down, we have a tension, and that's all we've got. Okay? And if you think about what this thing happens to be, forget that this is a spring, think of this as a fixed length spring. As it goes back and forth, it's moving on the arc length of a circle. Okay, because the string is not stretching. So it's a pendulum and we can say that it has the pendulum has a length L. So if we argue that it's moving on a circle, the minute the word circle is mentioned, what do you think automatically? What do you think harmonic motion, because we're doing harmonic motion. But besides that, if I just say circle, what's your mantra? Centrifugal, somebody said the word. Circle means that you have a net force toward the center, which is equal to mv squared over r. Right? Circle. Mv squared over r. Mv squared over r means circle. Circle. Mv squared over r. Alright? So, do the mantra. Because that's got to be automatic at this point. Okay, so we're going to use that information. So, let us suppose here's the direction toward the center. Here's the ball. I know that I have mg down this way. I have a tension this way. Since this thing stays on the circle, I know that the net force always has to be mv squared over r toward the center, period. So F net at any point is equal to mb squared over r because I'm moving on a circle. Okay. That said, what does that really mean? Let's take this mg and I want to break mg up into its components, which are along the line that involves the string and perpendicular to the line involving the string. And note that as this angle is zero, mg is along the string. As this angle opens up, the ball moves and mg opens up an angle with respect to this line, which is equal to that angle. So that means that this angle is theta. And what I have here is mg times the cosine of theta, and what I have here is mg times the sine of theta. With this pendulum, it's not moving to and from this point like the spring did. The pendulum goes back and forth like this. So along the length of the string, it's not oscillating, it's not doing anything. That's fixed, that's the radius of the circle. But this way, it's going back and forth, which means if it's over here, there must be a net force that's pulling it back this way. And that would be this mg sine theta. Okay? If I go to the other side, then I have exactly the same sort of picture, but mg sine theta is going the other way. Alright, so mg sine theta acts as something of a restoring force, trying to bring the ball back to its center point. So let's look at the force perpendicular to the string. Okay? That has to be equal to the mass of the ball times the acceleration perpendicular to the string in the motion along the arc length. And that is equal to mg times the sine of theta. And it's restoring, so I'm going to put a minus sign in here, because if I consider theta, what we're really thinking about is the arc length. Perpendicular acceleration, so that would be the second derivative of the change in the arc position as a function of time, right? Because what we're considering is a circle which has L here, have theta here, and I have an arc length S here. S is equal to L times theta. And what I'm really looking at here is the perpendicular acceleration. So it's the linear acceleration along that arc length. So I have m times the second derivative of the arc length with respect to time is equal to minus mg times the sine of theta. And the minus sign, in the way just like we did with the string, if I consider going this way to be a positive arc length and going that way to be a negative arc length, basically this minus sign tells us that we have a restoring force going back the direction that we came. But the sine theta is a bit crazy. So let me... never mind. So what do we do about that? Because this equation is a little bit unlike anything we've seen before. Let's suppose that we constrain theta to be small. This is one of these cases where we're going to make an approximation to try to understand what's actually going on. Let's look at the function sine theta. For sine theta, you pass through zero. And so when I look close to zero, it looks something like this, right? Thank you. suppose instead of plotting sine theta, I just plot theta. If I just plot theta, it'll be a line at 45 degrees. Didn't draw that very well, did I? Draw the line theta for y is equal to whatever theta is for x, I'll get a line at 45 degrees. If I draw for y is equal to sine theta for x equal theta, then I get something that looks like a sine curve. But the point I'm trying to make is if you look at really tiny theta, those two lines fall right on top of one another. Okay? For those of you who have had calculus and have a miserable memory of having ever done Taylor series expansions, a dirty word, you don't even remember what it was? No? Okay, so if you Taylor series expand sine theta, you will find it goes as theta plus some high power theta plus a higher power theta plus a higher power theta. So that means if you go to small theta, theta squared is really small, which means all these other terms drop out, and you end up with sine theta just equal to theta in the Taylor series. So there is mathematical formalism that backs this up, which I'm not going to drag you through nor expect you to do on a test. But I did want to point out that at small angles, sine theta is approximately theta. I know that there might be one of you in here who is honestly sitting there going, I don't care. I just went out of here. Why do I care? I've been in my calculus. I've done enough of that. Okay, here's why you care. Because look what happens if I use this approximation. If we say, instead of doing this with our pendulum, if we say, let's only analyze it where we do sort of this, smallish angle, okay? Then, mathematically, we get this equation. And we know that theta is equal to S over L. L is fixed. So we get M times the second derivative of S with respect to T is equal to minus MGS over L. MG and L are constants. So this gives us a formula which is, and M's cancel out. So I have the second derivative of time, second derivative of the arc length, that is where it's moving along the arc, times the time, second derivative with respect to time, plus mg over L times S is equal to zero. Second derivative and whatever quantity it is I'm measuring, second derivative in that quantity, constants times the quantity. Okay, constants times the quantity. This equation and this equation are of exactly the same form. The moment you see that, then you know that this simple harmonic motion, that the pendulum has to execute simple harmonic motion. More than that, we even know what its frequency is. So in this case, the square of the frequency is equal to K over M, K over M being the constants in that second term. So what that means is that for here, we have simple harmonic motion with the frequency of the motion, the square of the frequency is equal to the M G over L. Except M doesn't carry through, sorry. Just G over L. So the frequency of this motion goes as the square root of G over L. Actually just learned a lot about some harmonic motion. The frequency goes as 1 over the square root of the length of the string, for example. Right, if it's a long string, then the frequency is going to be a smaller number. A smaller frequency means you have a larger period. So a long string takes longer to go back and forth than a short string does. Yes? That's another thing we just learned. The frequency doesn't care about the mass. But it does care about G. And remember what G is, right? G is this measure of the acceleration due to gravity. Look at some sort of conceptual problems that we might run into. Let's say we have a mass attached to a spring which oscillates back and forth in X as shown by this graph, okay? And let's say at the point P, do we have a positive velocity and a positive acceleration? We have a positive, let me just use signs for simplicity. We have a positive velocity and a negative acceleration. Do we have a negative velocity and a negative acceleration? Negative velocity and a positive acceleration. With zero V, but you have an A, lots of things to think about. 6, let's say, is 0 V and 0 acceleration. What do you think? So, look at point P. Think about whether you believe it has a positive, negative, or 0 acceleration. And positive, negative, or 0 velocity. Think about which one you think you have. How many of you think you have a positive velocity and a positive acceleration? As a function of time. Well, let's see. Velocity is a increases, you effectively are moving this way in the graph. Okay? So, as time increases, if you're at this point of the graph, x is increasing. So that will give you a positive velocity. But if you imagine this being hooked to a string, you know that if you've gone past the midpoint, even though you have a positive velocity, you have a net negative force. So you'll have a net negative acceleration. So at this point, you'll have a positive velocity, but a negative acceleration. Down here, you'll have a positive velocity, but a positive acceleration. Over here, you'll have a negative velocity, because in time, you'll be going further down, but you'll have a positive acceleration. All right, so learn to think your way through that type of thing. Simple pendulum has period T on Earth. What is the period of the same pendulum if taken to the moon? Right, so the question is, would be T Earth greater than T moon, T Earth less than T moon, T Earth equal to T moon? Equal to the square root of G over L for our analysis on Earth. Omega is equal to 2 pi over T. So that means the period is equal to 2 pi over omega, which is equal to 2 pi square root of L over G. G on the moon is less than G on the Earth. It's actually 1/6 of that on Earth. So if G is less, then the period will be greater on the moon. So you have this. Okay? So it's not a... For simple pendulum problems, it's not at all crazy for them to ask to take the simple pendulum and put it in some other strange situation where G will be different or L will be different or something like that. And remember that G in this case came from mg being the force down. I put a pendulum on an elevator. It isn't G that's important anymore, it's the net force down on that object, right? So it'll have to do also with the acceleration of the elevator, and you have to do the free body diagram. I think I've given you, we'll see if it survives when I go over the workshop with my TA today, but I put on a problem in next week's workshop module that involves basically a pendulum on a cart going down an inclined plane, asking how the period changes. So it will involve having to look at that force and figure out. So you can't just pull out G. Okay? All right. everybody's sleepy. So actually, I would like you to stand up for your start for this next topic. So if you would just stand up where you are. This is my favorite part of the course. We will figure out. I want you to execute simple harmonic motion, okay? Just like this, it could be like that, it could be slow, it could be whatever you want. Just do some simple harmonic motion, okay? And start whenever you feel like it, and sort of look around, alright? We have like complete chaos, right? Everybody just sort of whatever, okay? Now, I want to make a point here, which is, I'm going to start walking from here going that way, alright? And I would like you all to execute simple harmonic motion, but with a certain frequency, sort of like that, okay? But it would be completely random, alright? But what I want to do is to correlate the randomness of the simple harmonic motion that we have throughout the room by telling you, I don't want you to start doing it until I am right in front of your row. Okay? And at that point, I want you to start doing your simple harmonic motion, okay? Starting now. I love this. But note what happened. We took that completely random shit and we created a wave. Right? And a big hit. But a wave. Right? You've seen it in stadiums. You know? What makes a wave a wave? You're sitting there in the stadium and you see this thing coming and you've got to jump up at just the right time. Right? And if you can imagine it being a really small stadium, so that effectively you're jumping up and jumping down, I mean, doing this, okay? You have to execute that simple harmonic motion at a very particular time. The person on this side of you, if the wave is coming this way, jumps up a little bit ahead of you. The person on this side jumps up a little bit after you. And it is that timing, the correlation between the simple harmonic motion, at the very, you can sit if you want, I'm almost done. The correlation between the simple harmonic motion happening at all these different points is what actually gives you the wave. Okay? So if I take a string and I start doing this, then I have this wave-like motion going down through the string, okay? But what makes it a wave? If I were to take a single element of the string and look at it, I would see this little piece of string just going up and down, just like a string. It would be executing simple harmonic motion. What makes the wave happen is the fact that when, as the wave is coming, this piece of string to this side of that piece has already moved up. And in essence, as it moves up, it pulls this piece up, which then pulls the piece after it up. So there's this correlation in motion as they go. And that's really what the wave is. Okay, so the simple harmonic motion, when tied together with the correlation, is what gives you wave. The way in which it is correlated and what it is that's oscillating gives you different types of waves. If it's air molecules, we call the waves that pass through sound. If it's electromagnetic fields, it turns out to be light, etc. So we're going to, now, next step will be looking at waves. So, okay, have a great weekend, and I will email you about the Q&A session soon. And you owe me a problem set.